Talking to a banker can lead to higher blood pressure. Add in a conversation about the 1980s, and you may need to consult your doctor.
You know, in the 80s, where we saw a 10% increase in interest rates, a 2% increase in interest rates today with the fact that the input costs are five times higher than they were before has the same impact as the 10% increase did in the 80s.
Hello, I'm Paul Yeager, and this is the M2M Podcast, a production of Iowa Public Television. This week, we chat with two bankers in Knoxville, Iowa, about balance sheets, economic outlooks, and how appearances can mean the difference between rent costs. Here is Leslie Miller and Casey Gerhardt. So, Leslie, how long have you sat in this office looking over the square here in Knoxville?
I have been in Knoxville since year-end 1989, so we've been in Knoxville quite a while. I did actually start my lending career in Davis County, Iowa, in the 70s, so I had a chance to view the 1980s from a lender's desk, as well as see what the impacts were to our local farmers. My husband farmed with his dad at that time and was an extension director.
Did you always want to be in banking?
Actually, I thought I was going to go into farm management, but a banking job came open that was in an area that would work for my family at that time, and I decided to do that instead.
So 76 to 80, obviously, major changes. Let's just discuss the 86 on sitting in here. What has changed about Knoxville since then?
Changes in Knoxville, just you know, from a more global perspective, we've had a situation in our county where we at one time had a very prosperous veterans hospital that operated here. At one time, there was 2,500 patients who were mentally incapacitated or drug addicted that were treated here, and unfortunately they closed that facility several years ago. And it took a major employer out of our community. Since then, we've had some manufacturing build up. You know, of course, we have in Knoxville we have Weiler's, who's a good manufacturer. We have Pella Corporation and Vermeer over in Pella, so we do have a decent manufacturing base. Farming wise, we've seen the number of farms shrink. And farm size grow bigger in that time, just as they have all over the state.
Casey, are you from this area?
No, actually, I'm from Northeast Kansas originally.
Northeast Kansas. So, yeah. How does Northeast Kansas end up in Central Iowa?
Well, my family moved up here about 5 years ago, and so that's it was a job change for me.
Do you see any comparisons between Northeast Kansas and here?
Not really. No.
Why not?
Well, so the quality of ground up here is significantly better than it is back home. Where we average, you know, 165 to 170 bushel corn, they're getting somewhere around 155 down there. In fact, I had a conversation with a friend of mine when I was back home recently, and he was kind of telling me about how things were going, and I said, well, why do you grow corn down there? he didn't appreciate that very
no,
much.
No, I bet not.
So it's a little bit different, and there's a significant climate difference, too. We tend to hover about 20 degrees lower in the summertime than they do down there, and then vice versa. Yeah.
So are you to the, when you say northeast, are you to the Flint Hills area yet, or is that a little farther west?
That's a little farther west. I'm actually, so I don't know if you're familiar with the Kansas Jayhawks.
Yes.
But that's kind of my territory.
Okay. You're right there in the Lawrence area.
Yes.
Do you cheer, or did you go to K-State, or did you go to KU?
No, actually neither. I went to a different, I went to a college in Kansas City, but I am a KU fan.
Okay. When you go through Kansas, and the times I've gone out there in traveling, you are hard-pressed outside of Kansas City and Lawrence to find anybody that cheers for KU. They're all K-State, it seems. Is that true?
Well, yeah. I mean, in the ag community, it certainly is.
Yeah.
So it's hard to find, but man, when you go through the heart of Lawrence, it's all crimson and blue. That's it.
So you live and die with basketball. You don't even discuss football, I'm guessing?
Well, it's not. No.
No. Yeah. Let's call it what it is,
no,
right?
It's, yeah.
All right. So your job, what is your main function here at this bank?
I'm an ag lender. I started working for Iowa State Savings Bank in 2014, so I've been here going on 5 years. A lot has changed, really, in just that short period of time. When I started, you know, we were looking at contracting somewhere around $13 beans and $4.50 to $5 corn, and right now we're, you know, obviously significantly lower than that. So a lot has changed as far as that goes, and obviously the cattle markets and the hog markets have taken a couple of hits too. So,
now, are you from a farm in Kansas?
We raised Hereford cattle growing up.
Okay, so. Where'd you get just the animals, or was there any grain around?
No row crop. My dad had a trucking business, so he wasn't home much to do any of that. So we just raised cattle and we showed them too. So.
Leslie, there's not many people in Iowa that are that way. I mean, it's pretty much you have a combo of the two, or am I just seeing the perception wrong?
Actually, in our bank, and I think you're right. In most of Iowa, about 65% of our customers are livestock and grain farmers. They're not specializing. Now, I'm sure as you move farther north and the ground is less conducive for cow calf operations, you will see less diversity there, but definitely more diversified in southern Iowa.
So, seeing Casey's, I'll ask you both about the customer that comes in and sit. Who would you say your typical customer is now?
As far as
what's their operation size? Is it growing? Is it shrinking?
You know, most of the customers that I see, everybody's trying to grow, you know, but in today's economic climate, it's pretty tough to do, you know, especially for the beginning farmer. It's, you know, if you don't have a significant amount of money to put down on a property, it's really hard to get in. Obviously, the purchase price on equipment and livestock is kind of holding steady. Iron is really strong right now. Most of my customers, they are diversified usually with cattle and row crops.
Do you find that the average age is going down, or is it some of the same people coming in, talking with you, or is there hope for a younger generation that's coming through?
Well, I think there's definitely hope. We just have to make it through this downturn, you know. But I have a pretty wide range of ages that come through. I see a lot of new farmers. That's kind of the thing about working with Leslie. We job share, but I do get to take on a lot of the new ones, which are typically a younger generation. So
a new farmer of today, is a new farmer of today different than it was in the mid to late 70s?
No, actually not. You have a situation in both eras where you have a young guy usually trying to get some land, and the land does not cash flow at that purchase price. So you have that situation developing. One of the differences between now and then is FSA and the state of Iowa have implemented some programs to help beginning farmers with lower interest rates, some longer repayment terms. And that has helped. Back in the late 70s, you had Dad co-signing notes. Now, the difference with Dad co-signing notes and what's happening today has not necessarily kept the fathers of these beginning farmers out of trouble, because what we've seen is Dad's maybe geared up some machinery, or they've gone out and rented some additional ground, and that's really put a strain on Dad's operation, much like the co-signing put a strain on the operations in the late 70s. So I think, and I'm also echoing some thoughts, we had examiners not too long ago and just kind of touched base with them on what they were seeing throughout the state of Iowa. And their indication is the father-son operations are probably some of the more fragile ones that they're seeing statewide. Yeah. Just because of the pressure of trying to bring a young producer in and gear up and grow an operation at a time frame when we have crop prices declining.
Is there a perfect setup for someone to get into farming right now? I mean, would it be better off? Because you always hear if I have no access to land, how am I ever going to get in? Mm-hmm. But if I don't have somebody, but if I have to put my father on the hook as my co-signer, or has helped me in other ways, I'm, like you said, hampering the older generation. So is there an ideal person to get into farming right now?
I think some of the people that have had some success more recently, we've seen people able to pick up some cows at a reasonable price. That was not the case 4 years ago. You know, we had really expensive bred heifers. That was a wrong time to buy some heifers and some cows, but those prices have moderated. There's not as much pressure from other producers. You know, it's more attractive for a lot of producers to go out and try to rent ground and compete with beginning farmers on rented ground. Some of the older producers don't want to wrestle with the cows. You know, they don't want to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning and check cows. And so that has allowed some of our producers to take a little bit of a toehold. The tricky part is finding pasture to rent and hay ground that's available, especially with some of the CRP prices that are thrown out there in our county that are much above what actual cash rental prices would be.
So Casey, if I'm trying to start my land, I mean, I think of the land around here, a lot of rolls, a lot of good stuff for pasture, but you're saying that, I mean, what Leslie's saying is the pasture is harder to find around here?
Well, yeah, I mean, in a way, yeah, it's the guys that have the pasture, they're running cows on it. So it's a hotter commodity in a sense because if you've got tillable ground, you're going to farm it. That's the thing.
Yeah,
so,
right.
I mean, you're not going to seed good crop ground down to put cattle on it if you can raise a decent crop.
You said we're in a down cycle right now. Why do you say that?
Well, you know, market prices are down. They have been for the last 3 years. And it's just, you know, the rising cost of inputs, that's not changing. You know, that's been an issue and something that we talked about, you know, in the 80s where we saw a 10% increase in interest rates. A 2% increase in interest rates today with the fact that the input costs are 5 times higher than they were before has the same impact as the 10% increase did in the 80s. So we're really struggling from several different points of view. Cattle prices, obviously, 4 years ago, they really shot up. We had $3,200 bred heifers. You cannot cash flow that. You couldn't cash flow it then when the prices were good, and you certainly can't do it today, and those guys are still paying for it. So,
what would be... I won't say magic bullet, silver bullet. There is no such thing. What would be a couple of things that would help the situation right now?
Well, I mean, if South America would go away, that would help. But it's not going to happen.
But they're a major, you know, I mean, that's our big competitor in so many things.
It is a global market. Yeah. Yeah.
The global market's both helped and hurt, is what you're saying?
Yeah. You know, there's so much competition. We import a lot of meat from Canada and Mexico. We get a lot of our feeder cattle and feeder pigs from there. So, you know, that puts a little bit of a strain on our guys as far as raising our own livestock and things like that. But it's more economical to purchase it cheaper and then raise it and sell it fat here. But, you know, there's just a lot of competition as far as our corn and bean and wheat markets are concerned from a global perspective. You know, it puts a lot of pressure on our import and exports. So, you know, it's been helpful because, you know, we've been able to expand and sell, you know, a little farther out, but also we're purchasing as well. So, you know, there's just tons of competition.
Darren Newsom is a Kansas boy who works for DTN, is on Market to Market on a regular basis. Darren said a couple of years ago, I don't know if it was on the show or on Market Plus, he said, I think somebody asked him, what would be the best thing for a wheat farmer right now? And he said, don't plant a crop next year.
Yeah.
It sounds so outlandish, but maybe that is what needs to happen, but that would never happen, would it? Because as a banker, you wouldn't let that happen, would you? If I walked in and says, you know what, I'm not going to plant this year.
If they could show me that they only planted half their crop and could make enough money to make all their bill, you know, provide their living expense, pay all their bills, I'd say more power to you. That's usually not the case, though. They usually need every acre they can. And what we've seen people do this past winter is really strongly look at the farms that they're renting and the amount of cash rent that they're paying. We have situations where farmers will say, oh, you know, that's the best land I have. But if you go back and you look at the crop history, you know, look at the APH on that farm. Look at what your cash rent is per APH bushel and decide from that standpoint what is really your best farm. We have a lot of farmers that will forget that middle 30 acres of that 40-acre field might be really good, but that the 10 acres of the border is really horrible. And so if you look at, you know, 40 bushel yields on that 10 acre outside piece with 200 bushel yields on the 30 acres, you really drop your overall average yield, but you pay the same cash rent on every single acre. So that was very critical. We had some people drop farms because of that. And interestingly enough, I mean, they actually asked the landlord, will you take less? No. And the landlord wound up renting it for less. I did have one landlord that came in. We have a Excel spreadsheet that we use where we kind of put together the average break-even cost given different bushel scenarios for corn and soybeans. And so I had one landlord come in and ask me about that. And told me what his cash rent price was, so we plugged that in along with some of the average costs that we were seeing our farmers pay for inputs. And it turned out that for that farm to cash flow at the rent he was asking, it needed 200 bushel corn. And the landlord said, it's not that good a farm. He said, plug in a 180 cash rent, which I did. And I think at that rate, it was about between 170 and 175 that was a break-even requirement. And he said, it can do that. I said, I'm just going to drop my rent to 180. He said, but I'm going to ask for it up front. Do you think that's out of line? I said, absolutely not. And he was at 220 to start with.
Yeah.
So he took a $40 an acre
right.
reduction. Just looking at the numbers and realizing that it just flat out did not work.
What's the percentage of landowners who are open to even listening to that idea, let alone following through and lowering it $40?
Pretty low. And yet I would love the chance to sit down and visit with them about some of the difficulties. A couple years ago when rents were first starting to adjust, or we were talking about landlords need to adjust rents, I was at a meeting. Steve Johnson, as you know, holds the farmland leasing meetings, and it was one of his meetings. And he was talking about how the rent situation at the time was too high. Rents needed to come down. And one of the landlords said, well, I just think farmers need to cut their cost of living. You know, my tenant drives into my driveway with a new pickup, and I'm driving the same car I drove I've had for 5 or 6 years. They just need to cut their cost of living. So at the break, I asked that landlord, I said, well, you know, what do you think is a reasonable cut? I said, you know, if they cut $1,000 a month, you know, that's $12,000 a year. I don't know of anybody that could really do that, but do you think that's a reasonable cut? She said, yes, that would be a lot. That would be very good if they did that. I said, okay, so the average farmer in Marion County might have 1,000 acres of row crop or more, but we'll say 1,000. That's $12 an acre. I said, Steve Johnson was just talking about the need for a $50 an acre drop. Oh, $12 an acre? Oh, well, that's not very much. That wouldn't really help that much, would it? I said, no, it does not. See, that's the point that Steve was trying to make to that audience that day. And was not hitting that, unfortunately, because they were just hearing drop in rents. I'm not listening anymore. So I do think landlords, they might need to think about what they think will solve the problem and then realize that it's not just their 200 acres, it's 1,000 acres that farmer's operating over. And the fact that something that looks like big dollars when it's spread over the 1,000 acres really doesn't make that much difference. I do always tell my cash rent guys to make sure that when they go to talk to their landlords that they drive the oldest pickup they have and make sure they wear the boots that are duct taped together and maybe have a couple holes in their jeans when they go now. So that was a good lesson for me.
So she's teaching marketing and public relations at the same time.
Every day.
We'll get back to life lessons, but also examples of why help can mean the difference between profit and a loss.
If you don't have a price in place that can be acted on, you're going to miss something. There's just too much computer trading moving the markets too fast for you to see something and then try to take action. You need to kind of have prices set in place.
This podcast is one of three market-to-market offerings with Market Analysis and Market Plus as our other two. All take resources to complete. And you can help in our efforts to bring you vital discussions by visiting iptv.org/pledge to offer your support. Thank you. Now back to Casey and Leslie.
What have you learned from Leslie, Casey?
More than I have time to explain. I tell you what, it's kind of I don't even know how to put it into words, to tell you the truth. It's really an honor to work for somebody who has more experience in her little finger than I may ever have. Very, very knowledgeable. So,
you said you went to a school in Kansas City, but how many people at your school were women that wanted to go into agriculture?
Well, none, and I actually was a physical therapy major.
Okay.
So,
well, there you go.
Pretty
Anything's
big
possible.
Yeah, pretty big swing. So, so none, to tell you the truth.
Right. when you started in this, I mean, how many women bankers were there?
None.
Yeah.
No, there was Joanne Merrifield was up in Mason City, and that was it. So
150 miles away,
yeah.
Another one.
And of course, the numbers expanded over the years. It was great when you did interviews at Iowa State because at that was – I was very, very lucky. I was right at the point where Ag decided we needed to have more women in, you know, as employees. And so lots of job opportunities out there for women at that time. We kind of hit a slump with the 80s. You know, nobody could get jobs in agriculture for a little while. But, you know, we're back at the ag conferences. I would say 40%, 35 to 40%.
Oh, I was gonna say it's higher. Yeah. I get the impression that it's more than half on many of the vocations now.
Yeah.
Are women in agriculture. And the only reason I ask that is, do you think that's going to change any of the conversations? Does a woman think differently about the books? I know in my house it is. she thinks a lot differently about things than I do. Do you think that will change the way we look at farming from a business standpoint going forward?
It might change how machinery is purchased, because I think that's more. I am not a paint lover by any means, and yet farmers do need to keep up with technology. There's certain things that, for example, individual row shutoffs. You might look at research that Iowa State has done in the central part of the state, and they will say they really don't pay for themselves. But if you look at our unsquare, unflat fields in southern Iowa, that kind of planter pays for itself very quickly. So, you know, there are some things that need to be done, but I do think that usually we see the women that are involved in a farm operation a little less enamored by new paint. They might also actually do a little better with farrow to finish operations, just a little more attention to the sows sometimes. Not all the time, but every once in a while.
You mean when they're walking through the barns,
yeah.
They will see something differently?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So we've seen that. You know, I think it varies with the individual. But, you know, Casey has come on board. She talks about learning things from me. I have learned a lot from her as well. She's very agile with her learning, great communicator. With our customers, and I think that's very true of a lot of women.
You wanted to butt in. I think you wanted to – were you going to add on that? No.
Oh, you know, when she was talking about women and maybe some of the advantages that they have, they're traditionally better marketers, a little bit faster with the trigger than men are. So,
yeah. Not as emotional?
Nope, it's not, and I don't know if it's a I don't know if they just separate it and they look at the numbers and they decide, well – the one thing that I talk to my customers about most of the time is, you know, where's your break even? That's Leslie was talking about, the break even spreadsheet that we put together. Know your break even. So if it's 370 and you know that you can contract 380 today, you know, and that might be the best you get for the next couple of months, take it, you know. And then obviously we can't offer that advice, but
the old Walt Hackney line, how much damn money do you want to make?
Right.
You know. But there's some truth to that, and that you're not the first person to say that. We've heard from various folks, farmers will some of the, I shouldn't say farmers because women are farmers too. It's not men. The men will hand off to the woman, to their wife or the farm manager, like you talked about, and they market the grain because they don't have that emotional. I know my father was decent at the marketing side of things, didn't let mom do that. She didn't have any interest. But that is a minority now on so many places.
And it's really good. I mean, if you're a husband and wife team or you know, however your situation is, it's good to kind of give that job to somebody else and let them help you with it. Not necessarily give it away. Ultimately, there's too much emotion, like you said. But it is good to share that because it offers a lot of perspective.
Because also, if you're out in the middle of doing something, you don't know when it's gone to 380. You don't know when beans, all of a sudden, something has happened. I talked to a younger producer a couple of weeks ago, and he says, I said, well, how does your marketing work, Will? How's that happening for you? He's like, some nights I just have to turn it off and go to bed, but I wake up and beans dropped 40 cents.
Yep.
So how do you help someone through those times that we're living in right now?
get yourself in touch with a broker. That's something that we push quite a bit. I mean, obviously, you know, we stay as current as we possibly can, but we can't offer that advice. But if you get yourself locked in with a broker that can give you a phone call or send you a text message or an email and say, hey, listen, you know, we hit your sale point, and so we're going to go ahead and sell that contract. That's something that's really helpful for our farmers, especially when they're out in the field, you know, at harvest time or wherever, you know, whatever they're doing. You know, it gives them an opportunity to kind of rest assured that that's taken care of with somebody. So we do push that quite a bit.
All right. Leslie, you had a bunch of papers, and I haven't let you talk about any of the papers that you brought in here at all. But I want to make sure you get an opportunity. Tell me, and I asked you earlier what, you know, about Knoxville a little bit, but what is different in this area versus other parts, and how does you know, a certain number on a survey matter and translate? How much do you get in? I mean, numbers are your life, I mean, in this industry. So how do you best, I guess, if you're speaking to a farmer right now who might not participate in a survey or in getting a broker or things like that, what's your best pitch that you can have to someone who might not be thinking that they really want to nubble down on the details or take the time to fill out certain paperwork and how it could help them in the long term? Give them a big pitch on why they should do that.
Well, first of all, I'm going to dovetail a little bit off what Casey said in terms of getting somebody that can help them with marketing. With the volatility that we have in the commodity markets anymore, if you don't have a price in place that can be acted on, you're going to miss something. There's just too much computer trading moving the markets too fast for you to see something and then try to take action. You need to kind of have prices set in place. So that's one of the things that it's not a survey item, but it's a to-do detail item that I think farmers need to do. From a survey standpoint, you know, I know we hate the ag census. I mean, I fill it out for my acreage, and I hate it, but 'cause some of the questions are so irrelevant. It's ridiculous. But it is important for us to get information to the government. And we talked earlier about CRP prices. That's one area where our local county committee has fought with the state the last couple of years over what were reasonable CRP prices, rental expectations. The state bases what they think are reasonable prices on 11 responses to NAS. That's 11 out of the 800-plus farmers that are in this county. So you look at that and you realize that somebody with a 7-acre acreage piece could be telling NAS a very unrealistic price, and that has just as much impact as somebody that's farming and renting 500 acres or 1,500 acres. So that doesn't help us, you know, unless we get more input. The other thing that is really bad is the fact that with the number of farmers we have, they need 51 responses to actually have statistically relevant information. So that's important to get them that information and get it to them accurately so they actually know what's going on instead of – they're basically guessing at this point in time. And the county committee cannot override – what the state is. They've tried for the last 2 years, but for some reason they have this philosophy that 11 responses to NAS in Washington, D.C. is more of a knowledgeable input point than the local county committee that actually knows what's going on, and I totally disagree with that.
And why do you think Washington thinks that way?
Because it's Washington.
That was simple. She said that before, yeah. Is what you're saying.
When I was in Washington, D.C., I worked for the American Bankers Association. I was the head of their Ag Bankers Division. And I remember one of the guys from USDA telling me, if you are here for more than 3 years, you develop what we call beltway blindness. You have no idea how the real world works. I went a couple months shy of 3 years, thank goodness, before I came back to Iowa. But totally agree with that synopsis, that you just really lose touch with the everyday because it's so remote. You don't see things happening every day. And I think that's one of the reasons the ARC program, you know, it's been very successful in northern Iowa. Unfortunately, the southern tier of counties suffered bad crop years in 2010 as well as 2012. In 2010, we were too wet. And we actually had lower yields then than we did in 2012. So, of course, when they rolled out ARC, you could throw out your worst year and you throw out your best year. Well, we had two bad years. So we still had one bad year on the books, and it's been that way until last year. So we suffered that short crop 4 years in total, the year it happened and then the first 3 years of ARC. So we've been penalized very heavily in southern Iowa. I looked at some figures. Iowa State University has their worksheets that they put out, and you can pull various counties. But you pull Marion County and look at what's been paid on ARC payments. We've gotten $6.27 on corn, and you look at O'Brien County, and they've gotten $206.51 on corn. So they've gotten $200 plus per acre on their corn acres compared to us. That's, on the average farm, if you're looking at somebody with 750 corn acres, that's $150,000 that we didn't get in Marion County, but they got in O'Brien County. And yes, the cash rents are a little higher in O'Brien County, but they're not that much higher.
And O'Brien is, I'd say, 200 miles from here, 250?
250,
probably,
yeah.
Is the best way, northwest Iowa.
Yeah.
So when you have these divides, is this one of the things that maybe you've learned from Leslie about the frustrations of comparing one to the other and how your area has to compete against everybody else?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we look at this kind of stuff every day, it's important, really important to understand what's going on around you so that you can kind of make an estimated guess about, what we can expect going forward here in Marion County as far as prices and things.
All right. From where you sit, you both get to answer this. We'll kind of finish a little bit here on some policy fun. The Farm Bill, by the time this airs, it might be out of the House Committee. But if you had a chance to, on a federal level, offer some suggestions from those that are working on the Farm Bill legislation, a couple of points that you would help them with right now? You want to answer that one? Either one of you want to answer that one?
If they're going to continue with ARC, they need to fix it so that they do not have the unfairness advantage that had kicked in for southern Iowa like it did for the rest of the state. I'd actually like to see them go back and adjust that. They adjusted the milk protection price or the milk price protection program. This is a similar situation. It needs to be corrected or fixed. We've all talked about crop insurance. It's so important. It's so important for the farmers and the lenders. There's a lot of farmers who got cut off earlier in the 80s because crop insurance was not as good, was not as widely used. Whereas if it had been in place, a banker might have taken one more year with that farmer. Right now, it's helping us survive some of the downturns. One of the problems with crop insurance is, in some people's eyes, it's too expensive. So in my mind, if you're going to try to limit costs, then do it by saying, you only get so many dollars worth of crop insurance subsidy. And I say that from the standpoint of, maybe it's okay to fully subsidize or, subsidize at the same level the first 4 or 5,000 acres somebody farms. But if they're going to go from 5,000 to 10,000, maybe that should be their risk and not taxpayer risk and their risk. Maybe we save those taxpayer dollars to help family farms. So that's one thing that, again, if they're looking at cutting budgets, mm-hmm. maybe do it that way instead of just saying, we're going to cut everybody's subsidy. I don't like that aspect. I'd like to see them do better with the livestock insurance, and Casey can talk a little bit about that. I mean, it's too expensive. It does not work as well, and that's a real challenge for our cow-calf people and our feeders that, just to try and lock some price protection in. So those are just two of my wish lists on the milk price protection program. They tried to fix it. It's still not fixed. Dairy producers in Iowa are particularly hard hit because the local co-ops that they work with, DFA out of Kansas City, reports that they pay a certain price for milk. And so NAS collects that figure, but they do not collect the fact that DFA then pulls off what they call a producer price adjustment factor, which can be as much as $5 a hundredweight on milk. So you might look at the board and say, the milk producers are getting $15, $16 for milk. No, they're getting more like $11 right now because of this producer price adjustment that DFA has put in place. And it's killing our dairy industry in Iowa and other states as well.
Dairy's had a hard row here.
Yes.
We were just up in Wisconsin not that long ago looking at some of their struggles. But, yeah, when you're outside of a key region, sometimes people forget about what you're doing. So, Casey, Leslie kind of said there's some livestock insurance. Do you kind of agree with what she's saying?
Absolutely. It's really hard to lock in a price right now. I've had, when you look at the charts and you look at the profit tracker and things like that, you know, since 2015, we've seen $300 plus decrease in profits for cow-calf producers. So we're looking at a projected $115 profit margin for cow-calf producers in 2018, which is really pretty skinny. It doesn't offer a lot of room for error as far as that goes. So, you know, it's really important that our producers look at trying to put, you know, hedge some of their cattle if they're, you know, selling feeder calves or they're selling fat cattle. You know, see if you can get yourself in a position where you can put a floor under them. That's been a big deal, and so we're trying to support that as much as we can.
All right, last thought: in 20 years, farms will be larger or smaller? The average per acre farm,
you know,
or livestock operation.
As far as that goes, there's been a huge push with these mega farms, you know, 3,000 head dairies and things like that. And so I think farms are I'm hoping that we continue to survive and get bigger, but I think there's going to be a significant push for those mega farms that are going to do all the work and kind of take away from some of our small town guys. I hope that's not the case, but that's kind of what we're seeing right now as far as trend line.
Leslie, you think the same thing?
I see a split, much like we've been seeing, in that larger farms numbers continue to go up unless they change the crop insurance situation. And smaller farms, more of the niche farms, you know, we might see more alternative farmers market kinds of farms. Some of those I also see continuing to grow. Unfortunately, that means the mid-sized farmers that many of us do work with, that number may be shrinking. I hate to see that happen. I really do, because you know, it's important to have that mix in agriculture, not only from a community and cultural standpoint, but from a lending standpoint. Dave Cole always makes the comment that you know, a Navy needs PT boats and battleships. And with the large farmers, we just have battleships. And if you lose one of them, it really, really hurts. So it's nice to have that mix, have the mid-size operators and the large operators, and let us learn from each other.
All right. I appreciate your time, Leslie Miller, Casey Gerhardt. Thank you so much, both of you, for spending part of your afternoon and helping us out.
Thank you, Paul.
Click subscribe and never miss an episode, or go back in our archives to hear something from our first 100 that is of interest to you. Visit markettomarket.org to do your shopping. I'm Paul Yeager. Thank you for listening.